Welcome to St. Louis on the Air and our legal roundtable discussion. Lots to talk about today. A scheduled Missouri execution is stayed for the moment, and journalists want more transparency in Missouri's execution process. Some prominent names in the news associated with legal issues: Francine Katz, Donald Sterling, and Michael Sam. And your cell phone. The Supreme Court may decide if your information may or may not remain difficult to get for law enforcement. I'm Don Marsh. Yes, some of the things we'll talk about with our legal roundtable panel. Joining me in studio, Mark Smith, Associate Vice Chancellor at Washington University and Director of the Career Center there. Bill Freivogel is Director of the School of Journalism at SIU in Carbondale. And we're joined for the first time by Barbara Seely, the Regional Attorney for the St. Louis Office of the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Good morning.
Morning.
Barb, good to have you with us for the first time.
Thank you.
As I say, lots to talk about, and there is more or less breaking news. As you all know, the Supreme Court now is dealing with the stay of execution that Justice Alito put into effect yesterday for Russell Bucklew, who was scheduled to be executed at 1 minute after midnight tonight. One of the things that interests me, and I know this is a procedure that is often followed, that there is an execution and the Supreme Court justice for the region gets in on it, but this is before the entire Supreme Court. Is this a little bit unusual?
Well, the particular justice who superintends this part of the country, and I think it's Justice Alito. Oftentimes, we'll decide to refer it an application for a stay, for a delay, to the whole court. So it's not unusual.
It's not unusual. But he didn't give any reasons in issuing his stay.
No.
No.
Okay. Well, this could happen while we're on the air, so we'll stay tuned for that. But the other issue I wanted to get to concerns the suit filed by various news organizations, including a suit filed separately by Chris McDaniel of St. Louis Public Radio, in which journalists are seeking more transparency with regard to the execution process here in the state of Missouri. Who is up to speed on what this suit is all about and how it's unfolding?
Well, I think we have two lawsuits, one of which is Chris McDaniel, I believe, and Reporters Committee on Freedom of the Press and a number of other ACLU, I think, is also involved
on that one. Chris's, I believe.
Yeah. And so that's one suit, and that's particularly on the statutory claim that the state sunshine law should require the disclosure of the compounding pharmacy that provides the drug to execute the prisoner. Then I think there's another lawsuit that not only makes that statutory claim but also makes a constitutional First Amendment claim. I think the Guardian is involved in this other lawsuit, and so they're also claiming that, well, the First Amendment protects the openness of court proceedings. For example, they can't really close a judge can't close a trial. So making that same kind of argument, well, so the execution procedure should also be something that's open, so that because there should be public accountability.
And my understanding is that it's based in part on historically the fact that the public had the right to attend executions, either in person or via the media. This lawsuit, the constitutional lawsuit, says that this should be extended to disclose the names of these compound pharmacies. This will allow the public to decide whether or not they want to go forward with these executions.
And I guess the argument on the other side is there's a Missouri statute, the Black Hood Law, that limits, that says, and it's not may, it says shall not disclose the identities of the people involved with the execution. So I think the state's making, saying our statute specifically says we can't give out those names. Now, the question is whether that applies to a corporation, whether it goes as far as who's producing the drugs, or if it's just the physician and the guy in the little room.
The drug is the principal issue here.
Yeah.
And a lot of this has come about because of that so-called botched execution in Oklahoma, which it took the condemned man 43 minutes to die, as I believe. And that is an issue also with the Russell Bucklew case.
Right, that he has a physical condition that may make it more painful for him under if he's administered this cocktail of drugs.
And right? This is presumably what the full Supreme Court is discussing, that part of this, because that's
what the Eighth Circuit considered, right?
That's right. Okay. Anything else to add about that as we await potentially some decision by the full court?
Well, one thing, in Georgia, the state Supreme Court recently upheld its law protecting the identity of pharmacies who produce these kinds of drugs. So this has been decided, at least at the state level.
And there are, you know, as you've indicated, there are other states that are involved in all of this. We've had the situation in Oklahoma. I wonder, and we don't know, but we can speculate because that's what we like to do. I wonder, with all the talk and everything that's going on with the death penalty here across the nation, are we perhaps on the precipice of a time when we'll do away with the death penalty?
I mean, the Supreme Court's cut back a lot on the death penalty in terms of minors, incapacitated people. I don't know that we're there yet, but they certainly are going in that direction, looking at a lot what other countries do. We're one of the few countries that still use it. So,
although you would never think that was the trend in Missouri.
Right.
There have been, I think, 7 executions in about as many months, which is as many as there had been in the maybe the previous decade or so. So this has sort of stepped up. We've got a governor and an attorney general and a state legislature, all of whom are very much in favor of the death penalty.
And of course, in Texas, it's become an art form
right.
almost in a sense. Well, we'll see. But there was such an outcry over the Oklahoma situation here. I think a lot of people are thinking about it and maybe in some cases rethinking.
So I'm interested what Bill thinks about this black hood, because we've disagreed on this in the past. I mean, do you think that protects the pharmacies?
No. And the law doesn't say that. The law just says the execution team. It doesn't say the pharmacy.
Well,
is the pharmacy part of the execution team?
Because they're supplying the stuff that's going to kill them.
I don't think so.
What the law says is that it protects people who provide direct support to the execution. So the question is the pharmaceutical company providing direct support? I mean, arguably,
direct
the law applies to people who are in the room.
Yeah.
Yeah, Barb took the care to actually look at what the words say.
Yeah,
It would be a statutory interpretation.
It says such as medical personnel who provide direct support. So I don't think that's all encompassing. I think that's an example. I think there's a good argument it could be broader. And if you think about the policy for the law, I mean, if we're going to agree with killing or not, that's what the state is doing, and the state. That's the law. And so they want to protect the people who are involved with this legal process because they're worried that there's going to be backlash against them personally.
Okay. Well, one other question.
I was trying to instigate Bill there, but it didn't work. Okay.
One other question that arises in my mind. You've got two suits here. They're essentially the same. Why aren't they put together as one suit?
Well, I'm not sure that the lawyers were talking to each other. I don't know. It's my understanding that one reason, for example, that the St. Louis Public Radio suit hadn't been already filed was that it was sort of hoped that the legislative session would end so that there wouldn't be the opportunity for the legislature, if there was a filing of a suit, to pass a law making it very clear that the compounding farm. So I think it's – I think there's some sort of strategy involved.
Nobody tells me anything, so I don't know. All right, let's move on. I want to move on to the Francine Katz case, which was front page news pretty much during the 3 weeks or so of that trial. She, of course, is the former Anheuser-Busch employee, female, high-ranking executive, who was charging gender discrimination, claimed she wasn't paid as much as the fraternity brothers, as one of the ways that she put it, running the brewery at the time that she was there. She lost the case. Barbara, were you surprised that she lost?
I was very disappointed. I wasn't surprised because it's a very, very tough case. The best case in terms of pay discrimination is something you would bring under the Equal Pay Act, and that's where the jobs that you're comparing are identical. This was not that case. This case was brought under the Missouri Human Rights Act, and it alleged gender discrimination in pay with jobs that were not identical. And the plaintiff Katz argued that she really did do most, if not all, of the duties or duties that were as important as those performed by her predecessor, Mr. Jacobs. The company argued that Jacobs was the executive vice president in charge of communications and that she was just in charge of public relations, which is a more lowly job. Under the Missouri Human Rights Act, this is what did surprise me. Under the Missouri Human Rights Act, what the plaintiff has to prove is that gender was a contributing factor to the discriminatory act. Under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, there's a higher standard. There you have to prove that gender was a motivating factor in the setting of the pay. So Katz chose state court for a number of reasons, but that is a significant reason. And I heard the opening arguments, so I knew what the evidence was going to be. And I really thought that they were going to put on enough to show contributing factor. There was discussion of the golf outings that she was excluded from. There was one fantastic story about how she had to go someplace on business, and she took a private plane, a corporate jet, going to the same place as another corporate jet full of men with empty seats, but they didn't want her in her plane, in the same plane. And there was testimony from August Bush, I believe, the third, that he felt more comfortable with the men on the strategy committee than he did with her. And to me, that is very good evidence that gender was at least a contributing factor.
But he also said that Jacobs was his advisor, and he went to him for many other things. It seemed to me, the layperson looking at this, that that was the thing that broke the back of the Katz case.
Well, that very well may be. I'm kind of skeptical about that, about how much of an advisor he was or why he was his advisor. You know, he was a male, obviously. He was an African-American with a long history of activism in the community, and he looked good as an advisor. How close he really was, I don't know.
Any thoughts, Bill? I mean, I wonder how intimidating it is for people like the Bush family showing up and people like John Jacobs showing up in front of a jury.
Well, I guess maybe they would be impressed by that. I mean, I think it's hard for a woman who makes a lot of money to go before a jury that maybe those folks don't make that much money and say, I really should have been making more.
But one of the jurors said afterwards that money was not the issue.
That wasn't an issue,
right?
Yeah,
but I wonder. But. I mean, I'm not saying that juror wasn't telling the truth.
I agree with Bill. It's hard to say, oh, yeah, I can see this, the difference between $1 million and a year versus $3 million a year or $6 million, whatever. It's outrageously high to the average person.
It was more than that. I think she was making $300,000, which is obviously a lot of
money.
But
I thought her total compensation was like $1 million a year.
Her total, well, when she got the stock options at the end of the Anheuser-Busch, it was more than $9 million.
It was something like $14 million.
$14 million.
Yeah, but that had to do with the stock options and having to cash them in with InBev.
Right.
The money certainly was a big issue in jury selection. Jury selection took over a day, and a lot of the questions went to, could you award money to someone who already makes, you know, millions of dollars? And a lot of jurors said that they couldn't do it, or potential jurors. Mm-hmm. So presumably when they got a jury, those people were able to put that aside. As Bill says, though, could they really?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I guess the next question is this ripe for appeal?
Well, yes, I think it is. I think they're going to appeal.
On what basis?
I have been told by one of the attorneys for Katz that there were some jury instructions that they believe were erroneous. And that.
Well, so that would mean if they won on appeal, which is a big F, but if they did, then all you would do is have to retry the case with new jury instructions.
That's correct.
So it doesn't mean that it's overturned, you win. It just means you get a second bite at the apple.
But more often than not, it means you settle.
Yeah, exactly.
We had I have to say that we had invited Marianne Sade, who was Francine Katz's attorney, to be on this program. And this was during the middle of the trial. If it were over, would she be on the program? She says no, because however it turns out, there are going to be appeals. So I think there's going to be an appeal.
Yeah, I think there will be, too.
All right, I have to take a break. Let's do that now. This is our Legal Roundtable discussion. With me in studio is Barbara Seely, the EEOC regional attorney. Mark Smith is with us, and as is Bill Feivogel, our regulars on this program. We'll come back to continue the conversation in just a moment, so stay with us. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our Legal Roundtable panel discussion. And we'll continue that conversation in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. As we previously discussed on this program, the U.S. Supreme Court is considering the case of Missouri death row inmate Russell Bucklew. Bucklew was scheduled to be put to death early today, but got a reprieve by the court late last night. The legal battle between the Metropolitan Taxicab Commission and the ride-sharing app Lyft is in its third day of a court hearing in downtown St. Louis. Lyft was hit with a restraining order by the commission after it began operating in St. Louis last month. And Arch Grants announced 20 new recipients of $50,000 grants this morning. The winners come from six different states and three countries. As a condition of the grant, they will be required to move to St. Louis for the duration of the program. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Well, lots of legal news again in the news today. Let's take up that Lyft situation for just a moment. Lyft, those cars that we see driving around town with the pink mustaches, as you've just heard in the headlines, a hearing is being held in court. The question is Lyft a cab or just a car? Thoughts, Mark?
I think it's a cab, and I think it falls within the definition of the law. And they basically have just said, but we don't want to follow the rules. And I understand that they don't want to, but the law is the law, and you have to. The Uber, which is apparently a similar application, is complying with the laws. So I don't see why they shouldn't. Now, having said all that, you know, this area of laws where you regulate competition, and it's always done in the name of public safety, and a lot of times it's really about limiting competition, and lawyers can be accused of the same thing. You know, we don't let just anyone write a will. You have to go through all these hoops. Is it to protect the public? Yes. Does it help us keep our fees high? Yes. So I think that's part of what's going on here. But I'm not particularly sympathetic to this guy at the Lyft operation.
Well, yeah. I agree. I think it's definitely a cab. And one interesting thing I read was that Lyft is from San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And it's from a San Francisco tech culture where there's a big disdain for government inefficiencies, and that may explain why they're fighting this so hard. It's just a culture thing.
Right.
Why should they have this inefficient?
And they're having the same
agency.
Problem in Kansas City, exact same problem.
Exactly. Bill, this gives you a chance to tell your Uber story once again, as you did last time.
I did take an Uber car out in San Francisco, and it was great and way cheaper than the cab, like half the price to get from Palo Alto to San Francisco Airport. So it's great to have the competition, but I agree with these two folks that it still can be regulated, but it seems like it can be regulated as a taxi cab.
Some eyebrows have been raised by the fact that taxi cab owners are a part of this commission, and therefore, of course, they're going to fight this because it is, quote, competition. Should those eyebrows be raised?
I'm always a little skeptical of any group that's regulating it.
Who can sell the
service and everything. There was an interesting op-ed piece or a piece by a local cab driver basically arguing that hipsters, who are the – Bill obviously
like
is a hipster. He's using the service, should not support it because he's saying basically – the core people, you think of cabs, you think of rich business people and college students coming out from a home from a wild night out. And he said, really, it's poor people who don't have cars getting to the grocery store, getting to church, to work. They don't tip that much. And, you know, so almost like they're providing a service. And then on the weekend, the business people and the drunk college kids are the extra money.
I'm just reminded of something, and maybe you folks will remember this. There was a fellow by the name of Solomon Rooks, I believe, in St. Louis years ago who was doing this sort of thing. He worked primarily on the north side and gave lifts to people who couldn't afford it otherwise. Does that ring any bells with anybody?
Yeah, I do remember that name, but I don't remember the details.
It seems to me that he was forced to stop doing that too. Maybe someone listening can.
I think there was a big ACLU case involved.
There was something involved.
Rooks,
it just popped into my head this moment. I wish I had thought of it.
Did
before
he charge for the rides? Or
you know, I don't remember. And I think he did, but it was very nominal, if at all. In any case, maybe someone can call and clarify that situation. I'm almost sorry I brought it up, except I'm really not. Okay. Let's talk about the Supreme Court now. A couple of things that have happened since we last got together here. The ruling on affirmative action and also on public prayer. On affirmative action, a lot of people have been headlining this as a real blow to affirmative action. This is the Michigan mm-hmm. case. Is it a blow to affirmative action?
Well, the Supreme Court made an effort to say, you know, this is not – we're not saying affirmative action is out. We're not changing – it's still possible under U.S. Supreme Court precedent for there to be narrow affirmative action that's in place in, say, a university to address issues of diversity. They have not thrown that out. So this involves a separate question of – can the voters in a state say we don't want to give racial preferences in higher education or anything else involving state
wasn't
decisions?
That what the ruling was all about?
That's
the
what
decision was based on the legality of the vote, correct?
The legality of the vote. So, okay. So you know, about 10 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court in Michigan, in a couple of Michigan cases, had said narrow affirmative action in college admissions is permissible. And so then the Michigan voters reacting to that said, well, but we don't want there to be any kind of racial preferences in admissions. And so the question was that constitutional? And the reason it was sort of a hard question was that there have been cases in the past where Democratic majorities said, well, we're not going to have fair housing laws, or we're not going to allow busing across district lines. And the Supreme Court in those cases said, if you're damaging a minority and putting them in a disadvantaged place, then even if it is a Democratic majority, those votes are not valid.
All right. Barb, do you have any thoughts on Barbara?
Well, yeah. I mean, the majority took the position that this case was not about affirmative action. It was really about who got to decide it. And obviously, Justice Sotomayor disagreed with that. Mm-hmm. And said it is exactly about affirmative action, and that the Constitution requires special vigilance in light of our history of slavery, Jim Crow, and the recent examples of discriminatory changes to state voting laws. So there's just a completely different way of looking at the issues in this case.
So what does it mean for the University of Missouri or St. Louis University or any other university outside of Michigan?
I think what it means, I mean, is it a big change in the law, the jurisprudence dealing with affirmative action? No, it's not that big a change. But I think you already have similar laws in California, Florida, a bunch of other states. I mean, this is like waving red meat, saying, why don't you do one of your state? And if they do one, then maybe race cannot be a factor. I mean, I could see these things getting passed in a lot of states.
Yeah. And in California and Florida, where they have passed those kinds of laws, the minority enrollments in their state universities have gone way down.
Okay. Well, if there's nothing to add to that, I want to go to the phones and backtrack a little bit, because Mike in North St. Louis may have the answer to the question about the situation here. Go ahead, Mike. You're on the air.
Yes. Good afternoon. The name they will call.
Mike, you with us? I'm not hearing Mike.
Okay. They will call service cars. Can
service cars. Yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
They will call service cars. And they ran strictly on the north side, and I think it was like 35 cents a trip. And the person that forced them out of business was Alfonso Cervantes in 1967. I think he owned a cab company. And they forced the service cars for, some kind of regulation type deal. But they ran for years, and they were excellent service. They were kind of like a big old yellow cabs, but they were black and yellow, I think.
But
thank you.
But Mike, stay with us for one second, because I didn't get here until 1971, and these things started up in the 70s with Mr. Rooks.
Okay.
Was that a separate deal altogether?
That might have been a separate deal, but I know for a fact this goes back into the 50s. I'm 64 years old, and I've lived in North St. Louis all my life. They were called service cars. I don't know who were the owners of it, but the that basically, and then also the American newspaper, they had a taxi service called the American Taxicab, and they're still in business right to this day. But they were called service cars, and they ran strictly on the north side. And I remember Mayor Cervantes, he owned some kind of cab company or whatever, and in some kind of way he was able to have them shut down.
All right. Well, Mike, thanks so much for clarifying some of that story for us. We certainly appreciate it. Let's get back to the Supreme Court now. There's still another question that maybe someone can answer for us on that. With regard to school prayer, or public prayer, I beg your pardon, of the Supreme Court ruling since the last time we got here, clearing the way for local officials to open public meetings with prayer, what does that really mean?
Well, the Supreme Court had previously ruled back, I think, in the early 1980s, that prayers to start legislative sessions were constitutional because they had existed ever since the beginning of the Republic and the First Amendment was written. That was called Marsh versus Chambers, and it was a case, I think, that involved Nebraska. So this town in New York was starting its city council, its city meetings, with prayers, and most of them turned out to be prayers. This is a mostly Christian community. Most of them were prayers from Christian ministers, denominations. Although after people started complaining, I take it that there were some other folks who were invited as well.
I think they had a Wiccan.
They even had a Wiccan give a prayer or at least say some words. At any rate, so the U.S. Supreme Court said that we had to look to the history that prayer had been permitted at the beginning of legislative sessions ever since the founding of the Republic, and they should continue to be permitted. There wasn't really the kind of subtle coercion that was involved in, say, graduation prayers at public schools. This was Justice Kennedy writing the opinion. Justice Kennedy is the person who did find subtle coercion in graduation prayers at graduation ceremonies in public schools, but he said there wasn't that same subtle coercion here. He did say at some point or another that, you know, if it would be a different case if it was a town that had a bunch of rabble-rousing ministers doing all sorts of divisive prayers at the beginning, that would be a different case.
And Don, you asked if this opens the door for towns to begin using prayers in their meetings. And I'm not sure. I mean, the court said this was a long tradition in the town of Greece. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know that if the town of, let's say, Kirkwood could suddenly start doing this and justify it.
I think they could. I think what I thought was interesting about the case, in the past there had been this kind of, is the issue that the prayer suggests that the establishment of a state religion, that, you know, somehow the state is establishing this religion and saying you're a part of it, or the coercion. Is this somehow coercing you into adopting the faith or participating because you want to get – and that it seemed like they were less concerned about the establishment and saying now it's got to be coercion. And establishment seems like an easier thing to prove. So they gave all these little factors. They were multi-decision, and there were a lot of different decisions, and you got a concurrence, but of saying what you can and can't do. So the thing about these religion cases, I mean, think all of them, they're always so fact-specific, and because you have justices coming and going with different views, and then they're looking at the particular facts in each case. Very hard to predict them.
In both the affirmative action and the religion cases, the absence of Justice O'Connor is very important.
Yeah.
Because Justice O'Connor, in religion cases, used something called the endorsement test. And what that meant was that if some practice of a municipality or a government made people feel like outsiders in their own government, in their own town, that then that violated the Establishment Clause. And Justice Kennedy, she's gone, replaced by Alito, who doesn't take that view at all. And so now the person making the decision really is Justice Kennedy. And Kennedy says there's got to at least be some kind of coercion. It might be a subtle coercion like a graduation ceremony, but there has to be some evidence of that people are being coerced into some sort of favored religious belief.
It's interesting to note that the majority were all Catholic, the majority of justices, and the dissenters were, three of them were Jewish. I don't know what that says. But
it is interesting. Doesn't each daily session of Congress open with a prayer?
I believe so.
Yes,
I think
does.
They have a chaplain.
They do, yeah.
There's something here that I'm not getting.
Well, I mean, the people who were challenging, I think this in the town of, is it Greece?
Greece.
I think they were saying, well, a city council is different than than a legislature. You know, you're sort of going there with your neighbors. And
you're going to get the variance on the zoning restriction, and this is they're going to be the people that decide, and what am I supposed to do, walk out while there's some prayer that I disagree with? And then you guys aren't going to vote for my variance. And so I'm being, you know, that was the argument. It wasn't accepted by the court. It was not accepted, but that was the argument,
right.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, we're going to move on. Before we take our next break, I'm going to bring in David from calling from Bourbon, Missouri. He's going to backtrack us a little bit, too, but let's hear what he has to say. Go ahead, David.
Well, hi, and thank you. My question has to do with the execution procedure. I'm not calling to discuss the efficacy of the death penalty or the lengthy appeal process, usually 15 to 20 years, I think. And I'm reminded, you know, during all this discussion of chemical execution in pharmacies and so on, and it's just, it consumes a big chunk of the news, it seems like. Many years ago in Utah, a guy named Gary Gilmore, a pretty high-profile case, he was a nasty murderer. He was executed by firing squad, and maybe the answer will have to do with what's authorized in the state of Missouri. But I think Utah solicited some prison employees as volunteers. You know, they remained anonymous. They were armed with rifles, one of which had a blank. So, you know, these participants couldn't be certain that they actually were shooting this man. And so that was that. What? Maybe you can help me understand why this continues to be such an issue. And again, it has nothing to do with the efficacy of the death penalty. Or so what's wrong with this picture?
Okay,
listen on my radio. Thank you,
David. Thanks very much. So we'll have to respond to this briefly, but it is state by state.
Yeah, I don't think it's a legal issue. I think it's a political issue. I mean, people have this view of the death penalty that, well, they're going to give them a drug and they'll go to sleep and not wake up. And the idea of hanging somebody, shooting somebody, electrocuting somebody is just – you can't fool yourself into thinking, well, it's humane. And so I think that's what – now, there may be some specific statutory prescription, you know, of what you can and can't do. I don't know what Missouri says about that. Do you?
No, but I mean, lawyers who are representing these death row inmates are just trying to find every possible way to keep them from being executed. And anything that they can argue that is cruel and unusual punishment and therefore a violation of the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution, they will argue. The appeals court here in this area, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, has said before we're really going to listen to these kinds of cases, the person on death row has got to come up with a way they say is more humane to execute themselves. So they've really put the prisoners in sort of a bind.
But it is a state-by-state decision as to how people will be executed.
Yes.
And I believe, again, correct me if I'm wrong, that someone proposed legislation this last time around to establish a firing squad here, but it went nowhere. Yeah. Okay, another break. We'll take that now and then continue our legal roundtable discussion. My guests in studio, Barbara Seely of the EEOC here, Bill Freivogel of SIU in Carbondale, Mark Smith of Washington University, all attorneys. We'll continue the conversation. If you'd like to be a part of it, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back to our legal roundtable panel discussion. A couple of First Amendment issues I'd like to get to here. The Supreme Court heard arguments since our last get-together with regard to searching cell phones. And there are a number of news organizations – this is not to do with the Supreme Court – who are challenging the Federal Aviation Administration's ban on journalists' use of drones. We've gone over this before. Number one, is that a First Amendment issue? Do you see the drone as a First Amendment issue?
I think it's a First Amendment issue, but that doesn't mean, you know, the First Amendment doesn't protect you from neutral regulations that would that would be passed by the FAA to assure safety in the skies.
Right.
For news organizations are arguing, and I think they can properly argue that there's There's First Amendment protection, but that doesn't, you know, exclude them from following the laws.
It's not a freedom of the press issue, period, end of report.
Yeah, I don't think it is. I swear I saw a drone go over Highway 270 over the weekend. I mean, either that or it was just an amazing model airplane thing.
What time of day was this?
It was in the daytime. I said, that's a drone. No.
I mean, what you're saying, and I think I agree, is it is a First Amendment issue. We're just saying that the First Amendment is not absolute. You can put time, place, and manner restrictions on our First Amendment rights.
Sure.
So but the idea that, just like with the people trying to take film with their smartphone, a cop arresting somebody, the cops want to say, you can't do that, but you can do that. You've got a right to do that. The government can't keep you from doing that. And I think with the drones, you're going to have a lot of people trying to restrict it because they don't want people looking at their livestock practices, or cops don't want people watching the arrest. But I think, as long as they're complying with these safety, these content-neutral laws, I think they got it right.
Why hasn't the FAA enacted any regulations?
I think they have some, but I think the suggestion is they may be overly restrictive.
Right. I think that's right.
It's early on.
But like, you know, police can say, okay, here's a police line, and reporters can't go past the police line. The reporters can't use the First Amendment to say, oh, I get to go past the police line. Cities can set up reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions to say Occupy Wall Street cannot camp at night because it's dangerous or it's a health hazard or something. And Occupy Wall Street can't say, we get to do it because the right to protest is protected by the First Amendment. So, you know, as Mark was saying, the First Amendment does protect these things, but it's not absolute.
And it's open to reasonable. And that's the question. Well, are these restrictions reasonable?
Right. I'm glad you mentioned the cell phone a moment ago, because I want to get back to the case that the Supreme Court heard just a couple of weeks ago with regard to the police access to information on our cell phones without a warrant. The information that I have looked at indicates that the course during the arguments was wary of allowing police this unbridled opportunity to look at information on the phones.
Yeah, because they arrest somebody, and then you can do apparently a search of the person and their car when you arrest somebody and impound the vehicle, and they find the search. So if I, they found a piece of paper that said, I committed this robbery with these three guys, and here's the pictures, that could be used against me. They don't have to have, because that's part of the search. I think the question is, with cell phones where we have so much data, maybe there's some expectation of privacy. And so I think the justices are really struggling with it. And this goes back to the things we've talked about a number of times, technology changing. And the law has a tough time keeping up with technology changes. What does that mean? Does that mean there's a password that they can't look on it, or can they get past the password? Can they look at incoming calls? That was one of the cases. They went to that house then. So,
or the GPS, I suppose.
Yeah,
you'd use
the GPS
that
thing
where
that we just
been,
did,
that
right.
sort of thing.
We just had that case, right?
Right, right.
Right. So it seems like they might be willing to draw a line between, say, smartphones and flip phones.
Certain apps and other.
Certain apps. It looks like from the stories about the oral argument, it appears as though they were having trouble finding sort of a bright line.
Right.
A bright line rule. But that if there's just been a really serious crime and they've stopped somebody fleeing from, you know, the scene of a robbery or something, maybe that's a reason where you have a search incident to an arrest to be able to access any kind of cell phone.
Well, there's no question there's an awful lot of information,
right,
as you've indicated, on those phones these days. Still with the First Amendment, and then I want to take a call from Marianne. I hope she hangs on. Donald Sterling, the owner of the basketball team out in California, the First Amendment and Donald Sterling in the comments.
Well, the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law. Congress means the government. He's not protected. Donald Sterling can be punished by the NBA for what he says, and he can't go to a court and say, hey, the NBA is hurting my First Amendment rights because the NBA isn't the government.
He's got a better argument under antitrust laws or something. That's if he wants to fight this, that I think would be his better mechanism than First Amendment.
Barbara, even private comments in the comfort of your own home?
Well, that's what I was just going to say. I mean, to echo the popular sentiment, and this is before Donald Sterling got interviewed by Anderson Cooper, where I think he just dug himself into a huge hole. But initially, when he was surreptitiously taped by his girlfriend in his own home, you know, a lot of people, and me included, have a certain amount of sympathy for him. I mean, you know, you should be able to say what you want to in your own home and not be punished by anyone for it, really. So, but, you know, as I said, then he goes on Anderson Cooper and whoa.
Well, he sure has said some stupid things,
he
no
sure
question
has.
About that. We'll get back to our list here in just a moment, but I want to bring in Mary Ann calling from St. Louis because she's going to raise an issue that NPR has been dealing with every morning this week. Mary Ann, come on in.
Yes, thank you. Well, I just wonder if you've all been listening to the reports about incarceration for failure to pay fines. I know that in Missouri, people do get incarcerated for failure to pay child support. And I know that it's a law in Missouri that counties may charge people for the time they've spent in jail while they're waiting for trial before they've even been found guilty or innocent. I don't know if anybody's gone to jail for non-payment of that, but I just wondered what your panel might know about all of this in general and for Missouri.
Mary Ann, thank you so much for the call. Basically, what the NPR series has, the issue it's raised, is that reestablishing a debtor's prison is what this amounts to. Thoughts? Barbara, you've been listening, apparently, to NPR.
I've listened to some of it, and one thing I was shocked to hear, I think it was yesterday, is that people who are assigned a public defender have to pay them. I had no idea.
Yeah.
And that's incredible to me.
I was surprised, too.
You know. Certainly flies in the face of the Miranda warning, which says you will be appointed a lawyer if you cannot afford one.
Which is why there are public defenders
to
begin with.
Well, but I will say to that caller, her example of child support I don't think is quite on point because child support, failure to pay child support is not it's not a fine. I mean, it's, you know.
You've broken a court order
yes,
of some
exactly.
sort. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think the Supreme Court has said, I couldn't give you a chapter and verse, but I think the Supreme Court has said you can't be put in jail for failing to pay fines. So I think the question is, well, you know, some of these may be able to be challenged in court where people are being asked to pay for the cost of their incarceration or the cost of operating the court system. You know, is that violating, you know, their right not to be put in jail because they can't pay a fine.
One of the examples they gave today was a young man who caught a fish out of season, and he was fined for that. He couldn't pay the fine. He was very, very poor. So they stuck him in jail for a period of time. I mean, that sounds a little bit ridiculous, I think, to some, but nonetheless, he was stuck for the bill and ultimately had to pay it, I assume. All righty. We've got to get to Michael Sam. I don't know if you are, as I am, a little bit tired of hearing about him. you know, let's see if he makes the team, number one, and judge him on the basis of what he does on the football field. But there was an interesting piece with either CNN or USA Today basically suggesting that he could be the result of some changing law or reconsidering of changing law in the state of Missouri, specifically with regard to employment of people who are gay. Barbara?
Well, Missouri, the state of Missouri does not have a law that prohibits discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. Nor does the federal government.
Right.
The city of St. Louis, however, does.
Right.
And I don't know where the Rams are located. If they're in the city, then perhaps they couldn't take action against Michael Sam if they wanted to.
I think it's Earth City, I think. Is that where they have their training camp?
But they still play their games downtown.
I don't know where.
It
could be. I don't think that the state legislature is going to change the law in Missouri to protect sexual orientation because of Michael Sam. I mean, I just don't. But I also don't think that he has anything to worry about with respect to the Rams getting rid of him because of that. I mean, if they get rid of him, it'll be because he can't play football well enough. I think that You know, I think that him coming out is great, and the acceptance of gay athletes is growing in colleges, and that is going to be spilling over into some of the professional sports like football, where gays have not normally been accepted. Some sports they have, you know, but I think that think times are changing. We're going to see more people like Michael Sam, and I just want to say I'm really glad that his TV documentary is being postponed.
Yeah, well, didn't the Rams forbid him being a part of that?
They were definitely involved in negotiating that to be put off.
Bill,
a good thing, I think.
As a journalist, your thoughts quickly on the way the media jumped on this thing. I mean, that the Michael Sam story became the gay draftee story and very little else.
Yeah, it did. Well, it's a pretty interesting story, though. I mean, because you've got – I mean, Michael Sam, he was, what, the outstanding defensive player of the year in the SEC, the biggest the toughest conference in the country. So if he had not been – if he had not been drafted, you certainly would have wondered if that hadn't been a factor. I mean, people were saying, well, he's small, and there would be other reasons not to draft him. But if he hadn't been drafted, he pretty came pretty close not to being drafted – you would have had to wonder whether the sexual orientation. So, you know, I don't know. I'm happy to be critical of my fellow journalists, but I might not be as critical on this one.
Mark, any thoughts about
it? Well, I just think it's interesting. You know, like Barbara was saying, you know, Missouri doesn't prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation. The federal government doesn't. And in fact, what was it, 5-10 years ago, the federal government enforced discrimination. You know, that was don't ask, don't tell was – If you go into an interview with the Army and you say I'm gay and I intend to have, you know, homosexual sex in the, you know, in the near future, they wouldn't hire you. They couldn't hire you. And now, you know, we haven't prohibited that discrimination yet, but it's we've gone from actively enforcing it to a neutral, more neutral, and the trend seems to be in the future to go towards protecting.
And there is a bill that's been pending before Congress for some time called ENDA, Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which would prohibit discrimination in employment.
And it's come very close.
Based on sexual orientation and on gender identity.
It's come close to passing, I believe, a couple of times, but doesn't get all the Republican support it needs.
Yeah.
Along these lines, Pennsylvania and Oregon, just within the last couple of days, have basically struck down courts in those two states have struck down bans on gay marriage. So this whole thing is really building some momentum, isn't it?
Yeah, it's going so fast. I mean, I think that we can see that if we could turn the clock ahead 5 or 10 years, there will be a federal law that bans discrimination based upon gender identity, right. And that all of these state laws that make same-sex marriage unconstitutional in various states, I think, will be gone.
I agree.
Yeah, me too.
All right. Let's take one more quick call, getting back to an earlier subject. Paul is joining us. Go ahead, Paul.
Hi. My name is Paul, and I'm a cab driver. I'm also a student at University of Missouri, St. Louis. And with the situation with MTC, the MTC would like to make the public think that they're fighting for the interest of the drivers and also the safety of the public, but I think the actual reason is just for their pockets. If you survey these drivers, one will find that the MTC has no support from those drivers because the drivers are being exploited, and they cannot even form a union because they're all afraid of what could happen if they try to form a union. And the licensing fees they pay, $100 every year. It doesn't matter whether you're renewing your license or getting a new one. It's just a cronyism for an organization that has no openness, being run by the
Paul, I've got to stop you there. We're out of time. We have just a response to it. If everyone picked up on what he was saying, did you hear, Barbara? Could you make out what Paul was saying?
Oh, it just sounded as though he thought that cab drivers were being exploited,
right?
And that this was just an attempt to for the cab companies to make more money.
I was hopeful that he was going to answer the pressing question of the day about those the service cars that we were talking about back in the 70s here in St. Louis. Well, that brings us to the end of our time. We covered a lot of ground today. Still a few things I would like to have gotten to, but we'll do that next time around. Barb Seely, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Enjoy your retirement. You're about to retire.
That's right. Seven days.
7 days.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah, counting.
But who's counting? Yeah, right. Well, all the best to you, and thank you so much for being with us. Mark Smith, great to see you again.
Thank you. You're not
planning a retirement anytime soon, are you?
No, I got those four kids at home.
right. The baby needs shoes.
Right.
And, Bill, you may be making a change.
Well, I am stepping down as the director of the School of Journalism, but I'm going to continue as a professor down there.
And you're going to continue with us?
And I'll continue with you.
Okay. Bill Freivogel, thank you. Barbara Seely, thank you. Mark Smith, again, our thanks to you. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about living successfully with ADHD. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.